Today is Monday, the 13th of September, and it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be reading to you selected stories out of the Sioux City Journal today. We're going to start with the weather, look at the five-day forecast, see what's going on there, and then we're going to turn back to the front page, review the mini editorial, the front page headlines on all sorts of local area and national news throughout the hour. There are no obituaries, so I will continue even after 30 minutes after the hour. So let's get started. Today is going to be partly sunny, high of 78. Tonight, low of 60. On Tuesday, a possible thunderstorm in spots during the afternoon, high of 75, low of 50. Wednesday, mostly sunny and pleasant, high of 77, low 59. Thursday, breezy with sunshine, high of 84, low of 63. And on Friday, intervals of clouds and sunshine, high of 81, low 61. Sounds like a pretty pleasant week. So let's look and see what's happening in today's mini editorial. Today's mini was written by Hillard Knudsen of Sioux City. Hillard says, does the Texas law regarding abortion remind you of how Nazi Germany relied on its citizens to report on their friends and neighbors? The Texas law is even worse since it will pay vigilantes to report on people. This is the opinion of Hillard Knudsen of Sioux City. Okay, today's local story that makes the front page is a picture of people who are climbing an outdoor rock wall in Ponca State Park. It will be one of the activities to try during the 16th Annual Missouri River Outdoor Expo, which will take place September 18th and 19th in Ponca. Outdoor Fun is the title for everyone. 2021 marks the centennial year of Nebraska State Parks, and Ponca State Park's Lynn Millick and other organizers were busy thinking up 100 activities for the 16th Annual Missouri River Outdoor Expo. Taking place at Ponca State Park, the popular Outdoor Expo will be held September 18th and 19th. Nearly 1,000 fifth graders from 34 schools are getting a sneak peek on September 17th. The best way to connect kids with the outdoors is through plenty of hands-on experience, said Millick. I promise they'll have plenty of things to see and do. Among this year's new events will be a chance to crack a geode. A geode is a hollow, spherical-looking rock. If cracked open with a chisel or a hammer, a geode may contain crystal, quartz, or other types of minerals. Other new activities will include glass-blowing demonstrations, trick kite flying, and even leather carving classes in which participants can take their handiwork home. Everybody likes a little souvenir to bring home, Millick said. Kids will have a spark of excitement from the Outdoor Expo. Hopefully they share this excitement with mom and dad since the expo is fun for the entire family. Along with a hunter's camp and youth fishing 101 classes, there will be plenty of things for outdoor enthusiasts. Some of this year's more unique offerings will be cooking demonstrations, utilizing Dutch ovens and pie irons, as well as sampling of kebabs made from buffalo meat. Lovers of wildlife may enjoy tagging monarch butterflies, making and taking home bird feeders, and maybe learning all about the turtles and snakes of Nebraska. Thrill seekers may find a bit of excitement on a rope obstacle course or by visiting a crossbow and archery range. We have something for everyone, said Millick. This includes folks with larger-than-life appetites. For the seventh year, Bob's Bar and Grill of Martinsburg, Nebraska, is sponsoring a Bob's Burger eating competition. Beginning at 3 o'clock on September 19th, guests may put their names in the hat. At 3:15, 10 contestants will be selected to polish off a classic Bob's Burger, a side of fries, and a 20-ounce drink. The person who's able to finish this humongous meal in the shortest time will be named 2021's Champion Burger Boss and will receive a two-night stay in a two-bedroom Ponca State Park cottage. If the winner breaks our 2016 Bob's Burger record of 4 minutes and 51 seconds, their certificate will be upgraded to a two-night stay in a four-bedroom mini lodge. But that's a lot of food. Checking through our list of events, Millick says many families have made the Missouri River Outdoor Expo an annual event. It's a wonderful opportunity to have some outdoor fun with family in a very beautiful place, she said. And there's a lovely picture of a young woman being taught how to pull back a bow and arrow at the archery range. And archery classes will be conducted at the Ponca State Park Outdoor Expo, a popular two-day event celebrating the great outdoors. Again, the expo will take place September 18th and 19th, which is Saturday and Sunday next weekend. Let's move on to other front page news. Manchin wants budget trimmed. Democratic Senator, key to Biden's $3.5 trillion plan, says half that figure is too much. A Democratic senator vital to the fate of President Joe Biden's $3.5 trillion plan for social and environmental spending said Sunday he will not support even half that amount or the ambitious timetable envisioned for passing it. The stand by Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, was described as unacceptable by the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, who is helping craft the measure. But Democrats have no votes to spare if they want to enact Biden's massive Build Back Better agenda, with the Senate split 50-50 and Vice President Kamala Harris the tiebreaker if there is no Republican support. With congressional committees working toward the target of Wednesday set by party leaders to have the bill drafted, Manchin made clear his view in the series of television interviews that there was no way Congress would meet the late September goal from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for passage. I cannot support $3.5 trillion, Manchin said, citing his particular opposition to a proposed increase in the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28% and vast new social spending. We should be looking at everything, and we're not. We don't have the need to rush into this and to get it done within 1 week, because there's some deadline we're meeting or someone's going to fall through the cracks, he said. Pressed repeatedly about a total he could support, Manchin said about $1 to $1.5 trillion. He later suggested the range was based on a modest rise in the corporate tax rate to 25%, a figure he believes will keep the U.S. globally competitive. The numbers that they're wanting to pay for and the tax changes they want to make, is that competitive? I believe there are some changes made that does not keep us competitive. But Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont, who is developing the budget bill, noted he and the other members of the liberal flank in Congress had initially urged an even more robust package of $6 trillion. I don't think it's acceptable to the president or the American people or the overwhelming majority of people in the Democratic caucus, said Sanders. I believe we all are going to sit down and work together and come up with a $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, which deals with enormously unmet needs of working families. The current blueprint proposes billions for rebuilding infrastructure, tackling climate change, and expanding in or introducing a range of services, from free pre-kindergarten to dental, vision, and hearing aid care for seniors. Manchin voted last month to approve a budget resolution that set the figure, though he and Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona have expressed reservations about the top-line amount. All of it would be paid for with taxes on corporations and the wealthy. Congressional committees have been working hard this month on slices of the 10-year proposal in a bid to meet this week's deadline from Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to have the bill drafted. Pelosi is seeking a House vote by October 1st, near the September 27th target for voting on a slimmer infrastructure plan favored by moderates. Manchin, who in an op-ed earlier this month urged a strategic pause on the legislation to reconsider the cost, described the timing as unrealistic. He's urged Congress to act first on a nearly $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill already passed by the Senate. But liberal Democrats have threatened to withhold their support until the $3.5 trillion spending bill is passed alongside it. Neither side on Sunday revealed how they hope to quickly bridge the divide among Democrats. "There's no way we can get this done by the 27th if we do our job," said Manchin. "There are so many differences that we have here, and so much. There's so much apart from us where we are. I'm working with people. I'm willing to talk to people. This makes sense. No sense at all." Manchin spoke on CNN's State of the Union, Meet the Press, and This Week. In other front page news, Afghan women can go to college, but Taliban government says classes must be gender segregated. In Kabul, Afghanistan, women in Afghanistan can continue to study in universities, including at postgraduate levels, but classrooms will be gender segregated, and the Islamic dress is compulsory, the Taliban's government new higher education minister said on Sunday. The announcement came as a Taliban official said Qatar's foreign minister arrived in the Afghan capital of Kabul, the highest-level visitor since the Taliban announced their interim cabinet. There was no immediate confirmation of the visit by Qatari officials. Earlier Sunday, the higher education minister laid out the new policies at a news conference several days after Afghanistan's new rulers formed an all-male government. On Saturday, the Taliban had raised their flag over the presidential palace, signaling the start of the work of the new government. The world has been watching closely to see to what extent the Taliban may act differently from their first time in power in the late 1990s. During that era, girls and women were denied an education and were excluded from public life. The Taliban have suggested they've changed, including their attitudes toward women. However, women have been banned from sports, and the Taliban have used violence in recent days against women protesters demanding equal rights. The Taliban did not want to turn the clock back 20 years, said an official. "We will start building on what exists today," he said. However, female university students will face restrictions, including a compulsory dress code. Hijabs will be mandatory, but did not specify if this meant headscarves or face coverings. Gender segregation will also be enforced. "We will not allow boys and girls to study together. We will not allow co-education." The official also said the subjects being taught would also be reviewed. While he did not elaborate, he said he wanted graduates of Afghanistan's universities to be competitive with university graduates in the region and the rest of the world. The Taliban, who subscribe to a strict interpretation of Islam, banned music and art during their previous time in power. This time around, television has remained, and news channels still show women presenters, but the Taliban messaging has been erratic. In an interview on Afghanistan's popular Tolo News, a Taliban spokesman said last week women should give birth and raise children. While the Taliban have not ruled out the eventual participation of women in government, the spokesman said it is not necessary that women be in the cabinet. The Taliban seized power on August 15th, the day they overran Kabul, after capturing outlying provinces in a rapid military campaign. They initially promised inclusiveness and general amnesty for their former opponents, but many Afghans remain deeply fearful of the new rulers. Taliban police officials have beaten Afghan journalists, violently dispersed women's protests, and formed an all-male government despite saying initially they would invite broader representation. A new higher education policy signals a change from the accepted practice before the Taliban took over. Universities were co-ed with men and women studying side by side, and female students did not have to abide by a dress code. However, the vast majority of female university students opted to wear headscarves in line with tradition. In the elementary and high schools, boys and girls were taught separately, even before the Taliban came to power. In high schools, girls had to wear tunics reaching their knees and white headscarves, and jeans, makeup, and jewelry were not permitted. A Taliban spokesperson tweeted Sunday about the Qatari delegation, saying it included the deputy prime minister, who is also Qatar's foreign minister. The Qatari foreign minister met with Taliban prime minister. The delegation also met with the former president and the previous government's chief negotiator in peace talks with the Taliban. The Taliban have maintained a political office in the Qatar capital since 2013. Last week, Qatar Airways became the first international airline to begin operating international flights out of Kabul, transporting more than 250 foreign nationals, including U.S. citizens, out of the capital. Qatar has also provided technical assistance, along with Turkey, to restart the airport, which had been damaged by departing U.S. troops who left Afghanistan on August 30th after evacuating tens of thousands of Afghans fleeing the Taliban. All right. We're going to continue on now. Another front page story. Unions divided on vaccination mandate. Some applaud Biden's directive, some are ambivalent, and others opposed. The National Nurses Union applauded President Joe Biden's proposal to require that companies with more than 100 employees vaccinate their workforce. The American Federation of Teachers once said vaccination mandates were not necessary, but now embraces them. In Oregon, fire and police unions are suing to block a mask mandate for state workers. The labor movement is torn over vaccination requirements, much like the country as a whole, wanting to support its political ally in Biden and protect its members against infection, but also not wanting to trample their workers' rights. Labor unions are a microcosm of the society we live in. The same political divide we have right now exists within the rank and file of unions. That divide complicates matters for Biden as he tries to get the Delta variant under control. Unions are a key part of the Democratic Party, and Biden has embraced them to burnish his blue-collar middle-class image. Dissent in Biden's own coalition may make it especially hard for him to implement new vaccination requirements. Some unions representing federal workers already objected to his push for inoculation among the U.S. government workforce, saying such matters involving new workplace requirements and discipline need to be negotiated at the bargaining table. In a sign of importance of the issue to the Biden administration, the White House reached out to union presidents before Biden announced his new policy Thursday, and will continue to check in with labor leaders who insist on anonymity to discuss forthcoming plans, said an administration official. Biden will require companies with more than 100 workers to give their employees shots or test them weekly. He will also mandate shots for executive branch workers and federal contractors with no testing opt-out. The new requirements could cover 100 million Americans. Momentum seems to be on the side of mandates. The AFL-CIO, the umbrella organization over much of the country's union, praised mandates in Biden's plan in a statement released Friday. The resurgence of COVID-19 requires swift and immediate action, and we commend President Biden for taking additional steps to help put an end to this crisis. Everyone should be vaccinated as one step in stopping the pandemic. The AFT 2 weeks ago mandated that its employees in the offices be vaccinated and has become a strong advocate of workplaces requiring vaccinations. Safety and health have been our North Star since the beginning of the pandemic. The union's support for mandates creates great cheer among two-thirds of our people and will create agitation in one-third. Still, many labor leaders are hesitant to wade into the mandate issue. Many of the employers of the workers of the Laborers District Council of Western Pennsylvania, like hospitals, have begun requiring vaccinations. Whenever members complain, the council's business manager tells them it's not the union's call. What we have said is we encourage our members to get the vaccine, but we're telling everyone to do so to go to your physician. We're trying to keep it non-political. Go to your doctor and ask your doctor what is best for you. Some of the most heated opposition comes from law enforcement unions. In Newark, on Thursday, police and fire unions from across New Jersey protested against the mayor's vaccination mandate outside City Hall. Police unions from Chicago to Richmond have pushed back against mandates in their cities. In Portland, Oregon, the local police union got its members exempted from the city's vaccination order, and a group of police and firefighter unions are still suing Governor Kate Brown to block the state's vaccination requirement for its workers. A political scientist who studies vaccine mandates at Penn State said it makes sense that the strongest resistance has come from police and firefighters. The more conservative side of the labor movement in terms of politics are going to be the police and firefighters. Yes, you're a union person, and yes, you want the workplace to get back to normal, but the identity of being a Republican outweighs a lot of those things. Bill Johnson, the executive director of the National Association of Police Organizations, said police officers are reacting like most Americans. You've got, like in the rest of the country, really strong feelings on both sides. Still, police unions can see the writing on the wall, and they want mandates to be negotiated through the collective bargaining process. There's a sense from the union perspective that vaccination policy is pretty much going to be mandated. We want a place at the table when we discuss implementation. Mandatory vaccine is such an obviously important public health policy that one official says she expects unions to ultimately accept it. She compared it to bans on indoor smoking, which rankled some unions years ago, but is a subject which hardly ever comes back at the bargaining table today. We'll get there, she said. Union had officially, like Biden, opposed vaccination mandates and said persuading workers to get their shots was a better approach. But after the Delta variant kicked caseloads higher this summer and filled up hospital beds, AFT reconsidered. I think that's it for our front page news today. We're going to move inside and see what else we have. We're going to move to the area of business and the Motley Fool. Ask the Fool. These are finance questions. Equity versus fixed income. Question, what are equity investments? The answer is, in the financial world, equity often refers to stocks, while fixed income generally refers to bonds. So a global equity mutual fund will focus on stocks from across the world, while a fixed income analyst is one who studies bonds. Question, I want to invest in Chinese companies, but I'm worried that it might be dangerous to do so. Answer, Chinese companies are very attractive to many investors because the Chinese population is so massive, recently around 1.44 billion people versus 333 million for the U.S. That means China has four times as many consumers to buy goods and services. Investing in any foreign country can be risky, though, especially if you do not have a good grasp of local rules and regulations and the reliability of information about companies in that country, along with an understanding of political, economic, and societal happenings. China has recently tightened restrictions on many of its big tech companies, for example, and may crack down further. China's largest ride-sharing company, Didi Global, had its app removed from app stores and was not allowed to register new users. Some Chinese business executives had disappeared from public view for months. A less risky way to invest in China is by investing in non-Chinese companies that do a lot of business there. Nike, for example, got about a fifth of its fiscal 2021 brand revenue from Greater China, which includes Hong Kong and Taiwan, and with that revenue growing by 24% year over year. More than a quarter of Starbucks company-owned stores are in China, and Pfizer gets approximately 6% of its revenue from China. School, about finances, annuities, the good and not so good. Annuities come in many forms, but must involve a contract with an insurance company where you pay a premium in exchange for scheduled payments beginning immediately or in the future. Some kind of annuities, such as fixed ones, can serve you very well in retirement, providing dependable income. With a fixed annuity, the rate of return and the payment amounts are specified. They're fixed and guaranteed by the insurance company. Fixed annuities are the simplest kind, and it's worth favoring them. Other kinds, like variable and equity indexed annuities, are more complicated and can be rather problematic. These annuities come in several varieties, each tying the return on your money and the ultimate payouts to a variable factor, such as performance of the stock market or bonds. EIAs, or equity indexed annuities, can have worrisome features like the insurance company's ability to change the rules. They often have an appealing selling point, including collecting payments tied to the stock market return, but not losing money when the market drops. You may not understand from the salesperson urging you to buy it, though, that your gains are capped. So if the stock market soars by 20%, you may only get, say, a 15% gain. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority and the SEC have issued bulletins or advisories about these kinds of annuities. They cite complexity, steep fees, restrictive terms, and other problems, such as the fact that you can lose money. Read the fine print of any annuity you're considering. Let's continue now to the news. Virus claims black morticians across the nation. In Mullins, South Carolina, when the last mourners departed the funeral and funeral director Sean Troy was left among the headstones, he wept alone. For five decades, the closing words at funerals in this town of 4,400 had been delivered by his father, William Penn Troy Sr. Now the elder Troy was gone, one of the many black morticians claimed by a pandemic that has taken an outsized toll on African Americans. I walked over to his grave and I could hear him talking to me. He said, "You got it. You can do it." He passed the baton on to me, so I've got to get running. He's hardly alone. Since the start of the pandemic, about 130 black morticians have died from COVID-19, according to the association that represents them. Deaths of funeral workers are not closely tracked, but the National Funeral Director Association, which represents the broader industry, said it has not seen a corresponding rise in COVID death among its members. But the deaths of black morticians are particularly notable because of a prominent role they have long played in communities. Often admired for their success in business, a number, including the elder Troy, have been elected to political office, served as power brokers, and helped fund civil rights efforts. At the same time, the homegoing services they arrange have frequently served as communal touchstones, drawing mourners together with pageantry, preaching, and song. Black funerals are more celebration, and that's no disrespect to my colleagues across the country. We're more intimate. The deaths have come despite concerted efforts by morticians to protect themselves from the virus and limits imposed on the size and scope of burial gatherings to keep it from spreading. We're getting bombarded with COVID bodies. At least 95,000 black Americans have died of COVID, according to the AP analysis, perishing at a highest rate of any racial group in the U.S. In Mississippi, funeral director Sonny Dillon tested positive for COVID earlier this year. "Just in case I don't make it out of here, this is what I want you all to do," he told his wife from his hospital bed. He died weeks later at age 72. Family members scrambled to keep the funeral homes in Macomb and Tylertown running in his absence. But there was little filling the role that Dillon occupied beyond the mortuary. In his 20s, he had been one of the first black candidates elected to political office, Later, he worked with the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. to rename a boulevard for the slain civil rights leader, and he pushed to get back more black citizens to vote. Dylan's civic role fit a pattern common to many African-American communities where morticians have long been prominent. The best known include a Ford family of Memphis, Tennessee, funeral home operators who sent a father and son to Congress. In Detroit, funeral director Charles Diggs Sr. was a state legislator before his son won a seat in Washington and helped found the Congressional Black Caucus. By late this summer, Georgia Dillon was preparing to turn over the business to her daughter and son-in-law. We talk and we cry and we try to build each other up. We tell each other we're going to keep his legacy going. In New York, Gaffney's trying to do much the same after years of practicing medicine while her brother ran the funeral home started by their parents. During the first months of the pandemic, Gaffney said she warned her brother, who had chronic health issues, to isolate himself. But his death weeks later at age 65 confronted her with responsibilities well beyond her expertise. With deaths soaring, she rented a refrigerated trailer to handle the overload. Every other week, Gaffney drove to New York from her home in Charlotte, North Carolina, to take on the responsibilities her brother had left behind. It's been an emotional journey. South Carolina's Troy has faced somewhat different challenges after years working alongside his father. The Troys had agreed that Sean would take over the business during the next few years, but he had expected to do so with his father's counsel, whose death left a void well beyond the chapel. The elder Troy, known as Penn, had served as county commissioner, local school board member, and church treasurer, but those were just his official duties. If my mother didn't have enough to feed us, he'd help us out. When you're talking about Mr. Penn, he was the community, said a former neighbor. All right, we're going to move on. Congress and Biden stalled on voting rights. President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats have vowed to pass federal voting rights legislation, but 8 months into his term, they are losing a race with Republican-led state legislators. 18 states, 17 with legislators under GOP control, have enacted new restrictions on voting, with many of the laws tightening rules around mail ballots, which were used widely during the 2020 election. Certainly, the efforts to make it harder to vote have been turbocharged this year. We're seeing truly unprecedented levels of new laws that make it harder to vote. It's not too late for Congress to pass legislation. Biden was a member of the Senate when it unanimously extended the Voting Rights Act of 2006, but 15 years later, the issue has transformed from a broad bipartisan consensus to one of the most contentious and politically polarized debates in Congress. State laws are being passed amid federal inaction, despite Biden and the administration officials repeatedly asserting their commitment to voting rights as a priority. Republican governors and state legislators have led the moves toward greater restrictions. Texas Governor Greg Abbott last week signed a sweeping new law that restricts local officials from sending voters unsolicited mail-in ballot applications. The new law that also bans 24-hour voting and drive-through voting, two measures used last year by populous Harris County to help with social distancing during the pandemic. Abbott, a two-term Republican, touted the legislation as making it harder to cheat, but election experts have repeatedly refuted the notion of widespread voter fraud and say these new laws indulge already debunked conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. Almost all of these state laws are based on an alternate reality that doesn't exist. It is objectively true that the 2020 election was the most secure and transparent election we've ever held. We're going to continue on to the world of sports. It was quite a weekend in that world. No Grand Slam for Djokovic. In professional tennis, a game from the end of his bid for what would have been the first calendar year Grand Slam in men's tennis since 1969, Novak Djokovic covered his face with a towel, hiding his tears during a changeover. For 27 Grand Slam matches in 2021 on hard court, clay court, and grass, Djokovic could not be deterred and could not be beaten. Needing one more victory in the U.S. Open final on Sunday against Daniil Medvedev to complete a season sweep of major titles and to claim the record 21st of his career, Djokovic could not come through. Outplayed by someone using a similar style to his own, Djokovic came up short of those two historic milestones, losing 6-4, 6-4, 6-4 to first-time major champion Medvedev at Arthur Ashe Stadium. What was in Djokovic's thoughts as he sat there on the sideline, knowing full well that his quest was moments from conclusion? Relief. I was glad it was over because the build-up for this tournament and everything that mentally, emotionally, I had to deal with throughout the tournament in the last couple of weeks was just a lot. It was a lot to handle, he said. I was just glad that finally the run is over. At the same time, I felt sadness and disappointment, and also gratitude for the crowd and for that special moment they'd created for me on the court. Until Sunday, the number one ranked Djokovic had been sublime at the sport's four most important tournaments, enduring the burdens of expectations and pressure over the last 7 months and in New York the past fortnight. He won the Australian Open in February, beating Medvedev in the final in straight sets, and French Open in June and Wimbledon in July, pulling even with Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer at 20 Grand Slam titles, the most for a man in history of a sport that dates back to the 1800s. The last man to complete a true Grand Slam by going 4-for-4 at the majors in a single season was Rod Laver, who did it twice in 1962 and 69, and he was in the stands on Sunday. The last woman to accomplish the feat was Steffi Graf in 1988. Djokovic, a 34-year-old from Serbia, simply was far from his best on this particular day. Excuse me. Energy-wise, I felt slow, said Djokovic, who could not create the kind of comeback he had in each of his previous four matches and the six others in Grand Slam action this year when he dropped the opening set. I know I could have and should have done better, he said. He made plenty of mistakes, 38 unforced errors in all. He was not able to convert a break chance until it was too little too late, going for just one for six. He showed frustration by destroying his racket by pounding it three times against the court after one point, drawing boos from the crowd of over 25,000 and a code violation from the chair umpire. A lot of Djokovic's issues also had to do with the number two ranked Medvedev, who used his 6'6" frame to chase down everything and respond with seamless, effortless ground strokes, much of the way that Djokovic wears down foes and delivered pinpoint serving. He was amazing. Just congratulate him, full credit from his mentality, approach, and game. He was absolutely the better player and deserved to win, no doubt about it, said Djokovic. Excuse me. In other sports news, the X's dropped Game 2 to Kansas City. The Sioux City Explorers showed plenty of fight on Saturday night in Game 2 of the American Association South Division Championship Series, but it was not enough for the X's to pull off an important win against Kansas City. A series of booming home runs led the Monarchs to an 11-6 win over the Explorers, who have, leaving the X's with one more chance on Monday night to keep their season alive. So tonight, they will play. Let me see if I can find that here. let's see. Tonight they'll play to try to stay alive. In college football, Iowa State losses to Iowa is a quote-unquote Matt Campbell issue. Matt Campbell has accomplished an awful lot in his first 5-plus years as the football coach at Iowa State. He landed the Cyclones in a major bowl game for the first time ever last season and won it. A program that was once a Big 12 shrug has become a power. He's beaten Oklahoma twice and the same with Texas. The big in-state rival from 130 miles down the interstate, the ones that wear black uniforms all the time? Nope, not yet. Campbell continued to be 0 for Iowa Saturday as his 9th-ranked Cyclones played an uncharacteristically erratic game and went down to a 27-17 loss to the number 10 Hawkeyes in a contest that actually wasn't as closely contested as the score implies. Iowa State scored a consolation touchdown on a drive engineered by its backup quarterback with 3.5 minutes remaining to make the score a little more palatable. Before that, though, the Cyclones had floundered, creating 4 turnovers and squandering opportunities. Other than some decent defense and an electric drive at the end of the first half, they didn't show much of anything. This was Iowa State's big chance. It had a top 10 ranking and a chance to really make a big statement on national TV by beating its despised in-state rival for the first time since 2015, before any of the current coaches or players were in Ames. Someone did some deep, deep research and found that in 140 games against ranked teams over the past 40 years, this was actually the first time Iowa State was favored against a ranked team. When it all evaporated in the mid-September heat, it had to be a bitter pill for Cyclone backers to swallow. "I get it," said Campbell. "It's not our kids' issue. It's a Matt Campbell issue. I understand the fans' disappointment. I think we and the players feel that same disappointment." So, once again, the trophy stays with Iowa. Okay, let's see what else we have to share with you today. In professional football, Minnesota loses to Cincinnati in overtime. The Minnesota Vikings began the 2021 season intent on proving a busy offseason would cure the issues that led them to a 7-9 record a year ago. The season-opening 27-24 loss they suffered at the stadium on Sunday would seem to suggest many of those issues are alive and well. A first-team offense that managed just 6 points in the preseason committed many of the mistakes in a game where the Vikings were flagged 12 times for 116 yards. Kirk Cousins was pressured consistently in a five-quarter game where he threw 49 times, and Dalvin Cook only managed 61 yards on 20 carries, a final one of which was an overtime fumble that set up Cincinnati for its game-winning score. Following a lengthy review that upheld the on-field call, Von Bell had stripped Cook of the ball before he hit the ground. The Bengals drove for a game-winning 33-yard field goal. The drive swung on a bold 4th-and-1 call from Coach Zach Taylor 2 quarters after his previous call in the same situation helped the Vikings come back from a 14-point deficit. The end result was just the Vikings' 3rd Week 1 loss in Mike Zimmer's 8 seasons. They'll travel west next week to face a Cardinals team that beat Tennessee 38-13 on Sunday. All right, we're going to continue now. See what other news we can share with you. In Kansas City, the Kansas City Chiefs rally over the Browns. Patrick Mahomes threw for 337 yards and 3 touchdowns while running for another score, and the Kansas City Chiefs came back from a dismal first half against the Cleveland Browns for a 33-29 victory Sunday in a rematch of their divisional playoff game from January. Tyreek Hill caught 11 passes for 197 yards and a touchdown, and Travis Kelce hauled in a pair of TD catches, including a go-ahead score with 7 minutes remaining, as the Chiefs finished off their rally from a 22-10 halftime deficit. The Chiefs won their 5th straight against Cleveland, including their 22-17 playoff victory, and their 15th consecutive game in September. They also pushed Andy Reid within one win of reaching 100 with two franchises. As for the Browns, they fell to 1-21 in season openers since returning to Cleveland in 1999, extending their NFL mark to 17 consecutive defeats. They have not won an opener on the road since 1994. Other scores throughout the NFL, LA Chargers 20, Washington 16, Pittsburgh Steelers 23, Bills 16. The Arizona Cardinals, 38. Tennessee Titans, 13. The Broncos, 27. New York Giants, 13. Eagles, 32. Falcons, 6. The Seattle Seahawks, 28. Indiana Colts, 16. So, some pretty big wins, including the New Orleans Saints, 38, and the Packers, 3. Jameis Winston and the hurricane-displaced New Orleans looked right at home in Jacksonville, Florida, with a dominating victory against Green Bay, no doubt to the delight of fans rebuilding homes and lives back in New Orleans. We're going to continue on and read Dear Abby. Long friendships take stark turn over finances. Excuse me. Dear Abby, a friend of 40 years is always saying what she can't afford, yet she owns property, has a 401k, always finds additional work in her field, and buys the cheapest groceries. She won't spend a dime, even when it's necessary. In a recent text, she was going on again about money, when I jokingly quipped, "You're probably a millionaire by now." She jumped on me as if I'd called her the B word and went off on a rant. I was dumbfounded. I apologized because she felt I'd badly offended her. When she didn't respond, I left it alone. This was a few days ago. This morning I got a text from her as if nothing happened. I'm no longer feeling like I'm her friend. Looking back, she was never a good hostess when I flew out of state to visit her. Nor has she ever treated me for lunch or dinner, although I was happy to treat her to lunch when she came to visit. I don't feel the caring, generous, giving aspect that usually goes with long-term friendship. When she was down financially, I offered. I have not experienced the same from her. I feel shot down and ready to call it quits. Your expert advice is most appreciated and needed. Signed, Falling Out of Friendship. Dear Falling Out, before ending a 40-year friendship, please tell this woman she hurt your feelings. Then ask why your casual comment triggered such a strong reaction. Her response to your reasonable question will tell you everything you need to know about whether your relationship is salvageable. In other advice, Dear Abby, I'm a stay-at-home mom of a 4-year-old son who is the light of my life. I truly enjoy our days together. For various reasons, my husband and I have decided he will be our only child. He will be in school almost full-time soon, and I will be returning to work. When I think about it, I get depressed. These have been the best years of my life, and I think I made a mistake by letting my son become my reason for happiness. I know we'll make many more memories together, but I feel it's kind of the end of an era, and I'm not sure what to do with myself. Can you advise? Signed, Mommy Moving Forward. Dear Mommy, this may be the end of an era, but it's also the beginning of a new one. Your son is about to experience the first of many growth spurts, and you along with him. In addition to his academic lessons, he's going to learn to become independent and relate to other children. Both are vital to his development as a person. Rather than dwell on your sadness, consider this a time of growth for yourself as well, and focus on the positive. Perhaps you can help out at your son's school. Volunteer if you have time outside of work. Depending on your child's extracurricular interests like sports, you may find yourself involved with those and busier than ever. Because he's starting school doesn't mean your role as a mother is done. Quite the contrary. Good advice, as always. Thank you to Abigail Van Buren or Jeannie Phillips, who is now the one answering these letters, and her mother was Pauline Phillips, the original Dear Abby. So that takes us to the end of our reading today. See if I can find just a couple more tidbits before we do a recap of, let's see, I don't think we had any, really, no local briefs. Today in history, on September 13th, 1971, the Attica Prison Rebellion ended. On September 13th, 1990, Law and Order premiered on NBC. And on September 13th, 1998, former Alabama Governor George Wallace died in Montgomery. Okay, and we are going to recap the weather. And today is going to be beautiful, partly sunny, high of 78. Tonight, mostly cloudy, low of 60. On Tuesday, a thunderstorm and spots in the afternoon, high of 75, low of 50. On Wednesday, mostly sunny and very pleasant, high of 77, low of 59. Thursday, breezy with sunshine, winds 10 to 20 miles an hour, high of 84, low of 63. And on Friday, intervals of clouds and sunshine, high of 81, low of 61. That takes us to the end of today's reading. My name is Barb, and I've been reading to you from the Sioux City Journal. Today is Monday, the 13th of September, and it looks like it's going to be a beautiful week ahead. I hope you have a great week. Thank you very much for joining me today, and thank you to the Sioux City Journal and to the Iowa Reading Radio Network for their assistance in bringing this broadcast to you today. Have a great week. Thank you for joining me. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. It may surprise you to know that the garbage that leaves your house will be preserved for centuries in a landfill. More than a dump, landfills are an engineered storage system. On the bottom, there's a thick plastic membrane and a layer of compacted clay to keep liquids from entering the groundwater. Above that, the fill area is divided into cells for each day's garbage. As trucks dump garbage into the cell, it's compacted to become as small as possible. At the end of the day, the cell is closed off with a layer of soil and perhaps another layer of plastic, making it water and airtight. Most garbage won't break down in this environment, though anaerobic bacteria will digest food and organic waste and produce methane, also known as natural gas, the same kind you burn in your stove. Because it's flammable, the methane has to be flared off, or it can be collected and sold for industrial use, or used to run electric generators at the landfill. America leads the world by a wide margin in garbage production, with more than 1,400 pounds per person per year. More than half of it ends up in landfills. And 65% of that is packaging: cardboard, paper, plastic, bottles, and cans, nearly all of which could have been recycled. On average, recycling costs about half as much as storing garbage in a landfill. So if you'd like to reduce your garbage footprint and your city's municipal waste cost, recycling is the way to go. I'm Scott Tinker, filling you with fun facts on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.